Raiders, El Pacifico, Bill Hendrick.
Welcome back here. Just taking a brief, I'm showing to my close personal friend, Mr. Northcraft, this Joe Bonamassa guitar. You see this thing, Dan? Guitar buzz. Now, if you know blues guitar, maybe you've heard of Joe Bonamassa. He's an artist that's making quite a bit of noise, and that's because he can't play guitar very well. No, I'm kidding. He's a great guitar player. People are following this guy, but the body type on this thing, it looks like it's an acoustic, but it's pretty interesting. And I'm a blues music fan. I don't say that because I want any particular adulation. That's another thing. People say that they like a certain kind of music because that's part of their, you know, the presentation, you know. So I guess what I'm saying is there's all kinds of persona in this world, and we all have personas, and that's just a fact. You can't deny it. Psychologists tell us that we all have different individual personas. We have, That's what we present to the world. What you present to your family is different from what you present to your professional colleagues and so forth. The person that you present to the lady in your life when you first meet her is going to be almost 180 degrees different in a lot of ways from the person she eventually gets to meet, you know, gets to know when you get married and you start living together. Never in your wildest dreams, and never in her wildest dreams, more to the point, when you first met each other and she was falling in love with what a stud you are, and you were sweeping her off her feet, never did she ever really imagine that day that you'd be sitting there in a chair crying like a baby over some problem, maybe a work problem, or somebody hurt your feelings, or I'm not knocking it, but she's suddenly looking at this guy who was all man, and now he's this, I don't know what I did, baby. You know, it's kind of probably a shock, you know. Probably the healthiest guy from that, you know, if you're a man, the best thing you can do is be a man to her, because you know that that's what attracts women. But pretty in short order, let her know, you know, I'm not, you know, there's day. I've had my days, you know, and I'll tell you right now. Well, aren't you going to protect me? No. No, you don't say that. But I used to joke about this, and I think it's a one that we ought to. What happens between the time that you were having the long walks on the beach to the time that she is putting parts of your body into trash bags and loading them into the back of a truck to dispose of them someplace out of town? What happened between those two? Well, nothing really. What do you mean, Phil? No, nothing really happened. What happened is she happened. You know, you just didn't see it coming, Charlie. See, the day she met you and you walked on the beach and had the candlelight dinner, that person was already the one that was going to put you into those trash bags and dump your body at the dump, that person, she was already there. What happened was, she happened on you, man. She happened while you were thinking something else. You know, I love these shows. I mean, I just love these crime shows where he had no emotion. Because I'm just like those people. How could they not have? And I now realize, I now am fully and completely accepting of, there are personality types in this world that we haven't even begun. We don't even have the first clue at the human animal. We're just now beginning to understand some of the types that are out there, you know. Now, let me tell you something. I was telling this to my stepson, Alex. We were coming back from a business meeting last week, and he was going on and on and on about, and as well he should. He's a young man in his early 20s, and we had just heard a business proposal, and he was very excited about it, as was I. But we're both coming at it from slightly different places. I'm coming at it from having been in business for a lot of years, and he's coming at it from now just entering his professional life. And I'm not saying that I'm smarter than him. It's just a natural, I mean, for you young people listening, believe me, I don't like anybody telling me how it is either. It's really, it's unnerving and it's boring. But even you would say and admit, if you've been further down a road and you meet someone and they ask you, are there potholes up ahead? I think I should tell you there's a few up here. And that's only because you went down that road already. If you try to tell someone, well, there's some potholes, and they go, don't give me your bullcrap view of this road. I'm going to go down that road. I'm just trying to tell you there's a, okay, you know, it ain't really that much different. I know it sounds simplistic. It's really not that much different. I'm telling you the truth. It's the same thing. It's not, let me just tell you how it is. Nobody really wants to do that. I sure don't. I sure as hell don't want to say to my kids, let me tell you how it all rolls out. No way, man. I want them to find their way and have a ball with life. But if you're going down there, yeah, can I just say something? What? There's a big-ass hole, man, on the other side of that hill. Yeah, but I don't think that... Well, okay, then you got to just kind of put your fingers in your ears like in those cartoons, like when the one character knows a big stick of dynamite's about to go off, and you're just like, uh-oh, here it comes. Bang! And then you see your kid staggering over the hill like, why don't you tell me about just like Donald Duck, you know, or whatever the guy's name is, Daffy. So we're driving home and he says, man, this is a beautiful thing. I said, yeah, it's got some good. He says to me, there's this and there's this and there's this. And I said, yeah, there is. I said, I just want to tell you something, man. I said, you know, there's an old saying in business. If it's too good to be true, it ain't true. He says, well... Because he'd heard that one before. And he said, well, all right, well, I mean, there are some drawbacks. Yeah, well, what do you think? And he says, well, I can see where there's this and there's that. He said, but they sort of are outweighed by the fact that X is Y and Z is X. You know, I don't want to give you the whole thing of what we were talking about, but he's... And I said to him the best piece of... This was absolutely the greatest thing that I could possibly say to him. I said to him, I'm going to tell you, Alex... Right now in my life, I would love to embrace a business model for our company that is going to ensure income. I can tell you, because, you know, I've been busting my ass my whole career, man, and I've had ups and I've had downs, and, you know, there's nothing like having a nice, solid income stream. But I said... You know, there's an old saying. I said, you know, you prepare for the worst. You hope for the best, but you prepare for the worst. And he said to me, yeah. And he answered like a lot of young people would. He said, that seems like a pretty negative mindset. Now, I had a lot of different things I wanted to say to that, but I'm just going to lay this one on you. You know. Positive thinking and all that jazz, man, you can take that and you can stick that you know where. Forget it. That's just the wrong thing to be talking to me about. But I didn't say that to him. This is what I said to him. When he said, positive, you know, that's a negative. You prepare for the worst but hope for the best. Seems I said to him, I got to tell you, man, because I've been there. That. Your worst nightmare, they do come true. I know that there's that saying, boy, your worst nightmare, you don't want it to come true. The worst nightmare and his worst, it happens. It does happen. The worst thing. Some of us think that if we think about the worst thing that could happen to us, that somehow we diffuse it, that we take away its power. You know, there's a thinking in Eastern mysticism that goes along the lines of, if you vent it enough, it won't happen. Maybe dreaming about bad things is a good thing. So there are psychologists that say that's a way that we unstress. That's a way that we let all that bad stuff out of our subconscious and we let that stuff take shape in our mind somehow, like in dreams, and we take the power away from it. I am living proof that that doesn't happen. I'm living proof. I used to dream about the bottom falling out, and it has in my life. So I said to him, I said, you know, you do, man. You do hope for the best, man. You do hope for the best. You work for the best, and you be smart, and you plan, but you got to be ready, man. Because I was telling him, at the end of a year or 2 years of being in business, what is the worst case scenario? You have to think about that. Well, I want to think positive. No, man, you gotta. What are you going to do if you're at this place and not at that place? What is your contingency, man? You must think of that. You have no choice but to think of that. Because I said, your worst nightmares can come true. And that's where, you know, when I learned that lesson in my life, all that positive thinking is fantastic. You know, and I'm sure that it's true and all of those marvelous things. But you just give me smart and hard work. And I'll you can keep positive thinking. Yeah, I want to have a good attitude, but it's better to have a good attitude so you're just kind of greeting the world with a smile. That's where you want to have a good attitude. A good attitude where you're sitting there going, oh, I hope. It's a waste of energy. Go out, work hard, make contacts, take chances, yeah. You got to take chances. To be successful, you have to take chances. You must. You have no choice. In order to be successful, you must take chances, and you also have to figure on something else that most people don't figure on. It doesn't matter what kind of person you are. The more successful you get, the more people are going to dislike you. Believe it or not, it doesn't make any difference how nice you treat people. That's got nothing whatsoever to do with it. The more successful you become, the less certain people are going to like you, until finally you'll know you've really hit the heights when they hate your guts. Now, that's the truth. But, man, that positive thing. So we had this discussion in the car, you know. And at the end of the discussion, though, we both sort of agreed this is a really good move to make. We're going to make the move. We got to have a whole bunch of more answers before we do. And that's kind of the planning, you know. And like I said, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. Because we've broken our ass to get where we are. And we've broken our ass to make the money that we've made. But, you know, to get further, we got to roll the dice a little bit. All right, we'll be right back here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show, as late as I am with this break. I know Dan's been taking notes, probably has been recording this segment, and will repackage it and resell it on his own private website. I have no idea. We'll be right back. Phil Hendry Show. If you do, Dan,
is
good luck.
Bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
Joe Bonamassa. We were just looking at Joe's pictures here on Phil TV and HD. He obviously is a guy that he's in love with a guitar. I mean, this guy looks like he's got like 100 different guitars. But I like blues music, and I'll tell you, if you're interested, Dan asked me, he says, you know, because Dan said to me, what is it with you and blues music? Now, he didn't say that, but some people will ask that. And I like blues music, but the way I came to liking or loving blues is very interesting, and it came to me at a very young age. I was probably 12, and before that, I was already a music fan that was a little different for an 11 or 10-year-old boy. Not that much. I bet you that kids, wherever kids are, whenever they're alone and they take a hold of some music, maybe it's the music source their parents have, maybe not, that we would probably be surprised at what it is they like. I mean, we think kids like what they like, hip-hop or modern rock or what have you. But kids like all kinds of music, you know. One of the kids growing up, they like classical music, show music, lots of different stuff. So I'm a kid of 12, or even younger than that. I would listen to my dad's jazz records. He had Dave Brubeck, and he had my father had a double album set that fascinated the hell out of me. It was a Benny Goodman live at Carnegie Hall, and it was the old discs. Now, first of all, those of you who remember vinyl at all, remember very flexible, light vinyl. If you collect vinyl, you'll note that it's rather flexible, it's light. It's easily scratched. But before that, there was a much harder, almost made of, it looked like it was made of some kind of a material that wasn't vinyl. It was a harder plastic, big, thick, heavy discs. Do you recall watching cartoons maybe, or maybe a Three Stooges, where they would throw those discs and they would shatter like plates? That's because they were as heavy and as impermanent as a dish. And my dad had these records, and they were so literally physically heavy that they came in boxes. You didn't really get them in a sleeve so much as if it was a double record set, it would be in a box. And he had this thing live at Carnegie Hall. I listened to this record for two reasons. I dug the music, especially Gene Krupa's drum solos, I thought were fantastic. I loved listening to his drum solos. And also listening to this, you heard the jazz fans in the background. It was a little bit of a history. It was a bit of a time machine because you could hear these sort of the Hepcats of the 30s. You could hear them hooting and hollering as Krupa would do these drum solos. So that's the kind of kid I was. I mean, I loved rock and roll. And I listened to all the music, top 40 music. But by the time I got to be 12 years old, 11 years old, I met a kid at school named Richard Wood. Richard Wood was this kid's name, believe it or not. And he came from a family, his father was an engineer. He had lots, typical Catholic family, seven kids in the family. He had one, two, three brothers and two or three sisters, you know. And I go to his house, and his father was an engineer down at Martin Marietta in somewhere down off the San Bernardino Freeway. And as much money as engineers made in those days and still do, this poor guy was struggling to keep seven kids fed and clothed and going to private school, Catholic school. And there was Richard, kind of the middle son. And he was a free-spirited guy, and I liked the guy. We met each other at school. We were both in the sixth or seventh grade. So I rode my bike down to his house one day. And he says, come on. So we got onto our little bicycles, little kids there in Arcadia, California. He says, come on, man, let's go up to the library. I go, okay. That wasn't weird for me because I liked libraries. And we rode our bike up there, our bikes, and we get into this library. And here's this little 12-year-old kid. I think he was about a year older than me. And I still know Richard. He's out there in L.A. someplace. He's still a music fan. And I'm following him, and he takes me right back to what they used to call in those days the audio-visual department in the library because they had records. They had all these records. And he says, yeah, let's get some headphones. I didn't know the first thing from this place. There were records, there were turntables, there were headphones. So we got some headphones, and he immediately goes over, this 12-year-old kid, and he goes over to the record library and starts pulling out Sonny Terry and Bronnie McGee and Lightning Hopkins, and he starts pulling out Sun Ra, and he starts pulling out Big Bill Brunzi, and he's pulling out... you name it, man, Lead Belly and Muddy Waters. And for 3 or 4 hours, these two little white boys there in Arcadia, California, at the public library, we sat and we listened. Oh, and the John Lomax collection was a mind blower. John Lomax was a guy that was paid by the United States State Department to travel the South with a tape recording machine. And he stopped at cotton fields because during lunch breaks or dinner breaks, the workers would break out their guitars and would start playing blues, folk music, what was called in those days Negro spirituals. This was very indigenous American music, and the United States government wanted to record it lest it be lost forever. And the only place you could do it was literally get into a car and drive down to these cotton fields. Well, Robert Johnson was discovered. Lead Belly was discovered. I believe Muddy Waters was discovered in these cotton fields with these recordings. And so we listened to that, too. And I'm listening to these thin little recordings of these voices from 30, 40, 50 years before. And I don't know why, I don't know what it was about me, but I fell in love with that music. I wanted to hear more of it. And when I finally heard what they called, what we called in those days, the Chicago sound or the electric sound, which was Paul Butterfield and Charlie Musselwhite, and this electrified sound of the blues that had come up the Mississippi River, as they say, from the New Orleans Delta all the way up to Chicago. When I finally heard that, that became a love affair that I've had for my entire life. And if you want to see me dance, and you don't want to see me dance, but if you really do want to see me dance, then follow me into a blues club some night, and you'll see me dance, and you'll probably see me get thrown out. I'm just kidding. We'll be right back. Phil Hendry Show. That's the story of the blues. It came up the Mississippi to Phil's house. Here, just a few more minutes to go here on this very unusual night. This has been a night sans character voices. It's been sans the usual satire and theater that we do. It's been without any of that, any of the bells and the whistles. And it just was a night where I felt like I would kick back and talk with you and talk a lot about myself, not because I've got an ego problem. I've got an ego. There's no question about that. I couldn't do what I do without an ego, but I don't think it's a problem. I'm not a narcissist, which means I don't think I'm overly involved with myself to the detriment of others. And so I think I'm healthy in that way. Now, this has been a night where we haven't, you'll notice, talked about the things that one might talk about when one does a talk show, because I couldn't be more sickened by the subject of politics. And by that, I mean, I don't mean that I don't respect politics. I do respect politicians. I respect people in Congress. I respect the president. I'm real old-fashioned that way. I think anybody that has the patriotic inclination to run for the House of Representatives or the United States Senate, I think the best of that person. I don't think the worst. I understand that there's things that happen in Congress. There are power struggles, and there's a way of doing things and a way of not doing things. I don't have a rancor or a venom or poison building up in me about the government. I'm not Joe Stacks, you know, whatever that guy's name was. Joe Stack, remember him? That he just couldn't take it anymore? And so whatever it was bothering that guy. And I understand that the tax code had somehow changed, and I understand all kinds of things went wrong in Joe's life. And I get it. And it sucks. And I'm sorry about that. And the way he tried to deal with that was by killing. I'm not talking about he killing himself. I could care less. He killed an innocent man. He didn't care. It didn't bother him. He wasn't thinking about anything other than what he needed. And I suspect that that was probably Joe's problem his whole life. The only person that was really important to him was him. What he needed, what he had to have, what he didn't get, what he wanted to get, what he didn't get, what he thought, what he didn't think, what he ate, where he slept, him. And when he didn't get what he wanted, he burned down houses, he took off in an airplane, he smashed it into a building, and he killed an innocent human being in the process. And don't think for 5 seconds that he didn't consider that option. He probably did, and he didn't care. Like he didn't care all of his life about anything other than him. So you can talk all you want about problems with the tax code and poor Joe this and poor Joe that. That guy should only be burning in hell right now, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't care what problems you got or what's going on with the country or how onerous this terrible totalitarian fascist commie government. Oh, my goodness, the American people, what an unlucky lot we are. Boy, I don't know what kind of a drug you got to take to get yourself thinking in that direction, but man, I don't think I need any of that. You got to have some serious problems, Jack, and don't tell me about Joe Stacks and how the system did it to him. That guy's a murderer, and he's where he ought to be. And I don't give a damn what his problems were. Everybody got problems, man. Everybody. So I look at the country that we've got, and I've said this as a joke, you know, many times on the show, but I say it very seriously now, because it happens to be a fact. If you open your eyes long enough, you will see something that is very, very true, and that is the person most likely to be violating your privacy, sticking a camera up your rear end, videotaping you having sex, videotaping you going to the bathroom, videotaping you doing something maybe you shouldn't do, the person most likely to violate your privacy and to share those secrets with the world is not the government. Today, we find that it is more often than not likely to be a neighbor. Just one of the great unwashed. One of the regular people. Now, that kind of throws a monkey wrench into what has been traditionally, you know, the sort of default reality for people. And that is, everything would be great if Big Brother wasn't staring up our rear ends at everything. Everything would be great if the government could just get the hell out of the way. Isn't that right? It's more likely that the paranoid and neurotic public that has existed, you know, since the beginning of time, the human race, in other words, the human race. You know, you're going to look at what's wrong with the country, you're going to be looking in the wrong place. It isn't that people are bad, it's that it takes all kinds. There's all kinds of weird asses working in the government, there's no question about that. But guess what, I got a newsflash for you. There's a whole bunch of them living on your street, too. I am very proud to say the following thing. And I know that there are many, 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 many people just like me. But I wasn't fooled by Joe Stacks, not even for 3 seconds. That guy was just a scum-sucking dog as far as I was concerned, regardless of the problems he was having. The minute he took the life of another human being, a veteran for God's sake, but let's forget about the veteran status of the man, just another human being, and in such a cavalier manner, his problems with Big Brother, his manifesto, his attempt to become something more than he was in life, which was a loser, it went up in smoke as far as I was concerned. But in point of fact, he showed us who he really was. Anybody who is that angry at a government that is the greatest that the human race has ever conceived of, he's got problems upstairs between his ears, and it's going to take a lot of medicine and electroshock. Forget about what he's crying about. I could care less. When I finally got looking into that guy's troubles, and I found out that he'd made a series of bad decisions, and then I took a look at how he ended his life, and I realized what we're dealing with here is probably a full-blown sociopath or narcissist. All of these decisions made by a guy with a mindset like that, you're not surprised. Those guys can't plan going to the bathroom for a bowel movement. They wouldn't know where to begin. Do I bring toilet paper, or what do I use? Are you kidding? No, I don't. So, I mean, I got no problem with the government. Now, you know, I'm not black, I'm not a woman. As far as I'm concerned, the only minority groups in this country that have any right to say anything are the following people: women, Jews, blacks, Native Americans. That's it. As a minority group, if you want to, I know that there's a lot of minorities, I'm not arguing that, but who have a legitimate right to say we were institutionally brutalized, not just by the American government, but by every government, by governments all over the world, by governments certainly in the western part of the world, in Western Europe, there was legal slavery, African slaves. America wasn't the only country. Women, Jews, blacks, Native Americans. Those four groups in one way or another, we're institutionally separated from the rest of society. And when I say institutionally, I mean there was a big fat brand stuck on him, either as a slave, as a money-grubbing Jew, she's a woman, she's a second-class citizen, or he's a savage. Those four groups of people, in my opinion, have cause to make the claim we were left out. All right? And the country, my country, has made every effort in the intervening years to bring those people back into the family of American citizenship. Everybody else, I take on an individual case-by-case basis, and that includes my Hispanic friends and my Asian Pacific friends. Yes, even my Japanese American friends, the internment, a terrible thing. There was an attempt to, as I say, redress that with reparations. But all of the other so-called minorities... Oh, excuse me. I left out one group of people. I apologize. Gay people. Women, Jews, blacks, Native Americans, and gay people. Those five groups of people institutionally brutalized by this country and many others. Institutionally victimized, institutionally separated and branded, and there ain't no getting around it. Everybody else, I take on an individual case-by-case basis. Well, wait a minute, Phil. I'm Chinese-American. That's great, but you know what? Your name is what it is, and I'm going to talk to you about your problems, and I get it that it was tough for your grandfather when he's building the railroads. You don't understand. There's people saying, yeah, man. Because what I find is it gradually becomes a state of mind and a condition that cannot be relieved or alleviated by anything. It just is. You know, I am a minority. It's kind of like people who are, I'm a cancer survivor. At what point do you stop being a cancer survivor and you just start living? Can you tell me that? At what point do you stop being a cancer survivor and identifying yourself as a cancer survivor and going to meetings as a cancer survivor and walking down the street as a cancer survivor and going into the house as a cancer? At what point do you stop with that and just start living? You know, that's the problem we got, man. Yeah, I know you had cancer. That's and you survived. Fantastic. I'm glad to see that you've survived, okay? Are you done with your cancer survivor meetings now? Well, how dare you? Why would you... Wait a minute. What do you mean, how dare I? What is it, for the rest of your life you want to be a cancer survivor so everybody's got to walk on eggshells around your stupid ass? Stop with your cancer survivor. You're a survivor. You're alive. You're walking down the street. Everything's good. Fantastic. Well, you know, I had a double mastectomy. Well, you know, okay. So you can get yourself some reconstructive surgery. What, are you going to become a reconstructive surgery survivor? Stop it. And stop being a minority. But having said that, in my studies, gay people, Native Americans, black people, women, and Jewish people were very much branded as outsiders, as the other, which is a term they use in psychology. You can grow up feeling like you're the other. You're not a part of. You are the other. And this is a real and very destructive frame of mind for some people to have. All right. We'll be right back. Let's see if I've left anybody else out. I don't think so. World famous Phil Hendry Show on this, an unusual Monday night, but nonetheless, unnecessary Monday night. We'll be back. Don't forget
Truth
the Lions
is
versus
our
Tucson,
bitch.
Man.
The Phil Hendry Show.
PhilHendryShow.com. That's one thing it is. My name's on it, so it's got to be that. And I've had a very pleasant evening with you. I hope you did, too. Talking about some of the things that I believe, because I'm so important, aren't I? Well, if you're listening to my show, I guess that's what you probably don't think I'm important, nor should you. But there's some part of you that says, well, I want to hear what he has to say about certain things. Now, the last comment that I made about this whole cancer survivor, you've heard people, the victimhood thing. There's one other area that we were talking about during the break that is always fascinating to me, and that's people that are recovering alcoholics making, as Dan mentioned during the break, making a big proclamation. I'm a recovering alcoholic. You know, I don't really care. You know, and if you're looking for me to pat you on the ass, I don't care. What you just did there, man, is you've taken one half of a step. Actually, you took one step of the two necessary to do what I think you're about to do, which is what? Tell me that you're in AA? Yeah. Okay. You know, people don't much care anymore, I guess, but AA is called AA for a reason. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's a reason why they call it Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with the individual alcoholic. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the individual not telling anybody he's an alcoholic to protect his reputation. No one gives a good sweet Jesus about your reputation, Mr. Alcoholic. You know, you got a lot of work to do before anybody cares about your reputation. It's about AA's reputation. That's why they put that provision. It's not a deal breaker. You're not going to get thrown out of AA. It's an extremely loose organization, for starters. There is no national, necessarily any national leadership council of AA. They've got books that they sell. They have publications that they sell. But AA is loosely affiliated with these individual groups. But the point I'm making here is the reason why they call it Alcoholics Anonymous is they don't want anybody going out into the world and saying, I'm an alcoholic, I go to AA, yeah? Because when a guy says, I'm a recovering alcoholic, the next question is, do you go to AA? And it could very well be, maybe it's a 50% chance that, yeah, I do. Well, what happened there then is the following thing. When that guy falls off the wagon, if that's what you want to call it, and let's just call it what they call it in AA is a slip, which actually sounds kinder. That guy starts drinking. Guess who the average person is going to blame? They're going to blame AA because that guy, not working the program, maybe not going to meetings, whatever it was he was doing, it ain't working. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous has been around since the 30s. It is regarded by some as the most successful drug treatment program in history. I think that that's a fair statement. I would like to know any other program that has treated, if you want to call it that, drug addicts or alcoholics as successfully as Alcoholics Anonymous. It was an organization that was formed out of desperation. It was the desperate move of a man by the name of Bill W., Bill Wilson, who was going to go back to drinking. He was going to go back to drinking, which because he had had some horrifying bouts with drinking, DTs, sickness. He'd been in and out of hospitals. He felt that he was on his way back to taking a drink. He was out of town. I think he was in Cleveland. He had to do something, and he got the name of a hospital where they treated alcoholics, and he went to that hospital and asked one of the doctors, can I talk to one of these men? And doctor's like, why? He said, because it's going to help me. It's going to help me not drink. Now, I know this story because I was in Al-Anon myself in the 70s. I had two friends that were alcoholics. Now, here's the thing. When you go out there and you say, I'm in AA, people go, oh, wow. And when they see you take a drink, it is the feeling of Alcoholics Anonymous with the feeling of Bill W. and those that contributed to what they call the Big Book that now you've just, you know, basically told everybody that AA doesn't work. And we know that it does. Millions and millions and millions of people have been helped. But when you go out there and start telling everybody about your affiliation with AA, then guess what happens? You wind up reflecting poorly on the organization if you go out and take a drink. Better not to say anything at all. Just shut up. Okay? What is it? I'm a recovering alcoholic. Who cares, man? Do you think that it means anything? Even if you were the most successful recovering alcoholic in the history of the world, you saying you're a recovering alcoholic, the likelihood of that helping someone more than the giddy thrill you get out of the ego trip of telling everybody that is very slim, in my opinion. That's just me. You know, you want to help another alcoholic, there's ways of doing it, and you can do it in AA, you can do it the way Bill W. did it, you can do it one-on-one, but getting on TV or whatever the hell it is they want to do, hi, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and then you turn around and you have, I remember Dick Van Dyke, a whole big movie about Dick Van Dyke had the DTs, and he was an alcoholic, he was a drunk, and, you know, he made the movie about himself. And the fact that he went to AA, and they finally asked him, are you drinking now? And he says, I drink wine occasionally. Now, that's not a recovering alcoholic. What Dick Van Dyke basically admitted to was that he slipped. He's not a recovering alcoholic. He's back to drinking. I don't know what happened to Dick Van Dyke in his life. I don't know where he is or what he's doing. I don't even know if the guy's still alive. But I can tell you that what he admitted to there was a terrible thing. And it reflected poorly, again, on a group like AA, because now they're saying, I thought you're not supposed to drink if you're an AA. According to Dick Van Dyke, he can drink a little white wine or a little light wine or a little something. The world-famous Phil Henry Show, I do appreciate you hanging with me tonight, folks, on this Monday night. Back tomorrow night, Bud Dickman, Robert Leonard, and you here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show. And don't forget to visit us online at philhenryshow.com. where you can get our backstage pass and access to all of the marvelous archives that we have got. Until tonight at 10, let that be a lesson to you.
Good night.
So you were there all that.
Phil Henry.